Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1105. Follow ID10T on Instagram. Go to ID10T.com for fun, new, and vintage items. Sign up for the ID10T email list at the aforementioned ID10T.com. Okay, enough with the plugging. Let's get to this episode, which I think this is really a fantastic episode to wrap up 2020. And I will say, you know, I hope this year of podcasts has helped distract you, help from an otherwise very stressful year, help give you some positive takeaways, some fun things, or like I said, just allow you to kind of zone out for an hour, you know, and sort of shut everything else off. I appreciate you. I appreciate that you've listened to this podcast for, oh my gosh. I mean, even if you haven't been around since the beginning, I appreciate that you listened to it at all. Maybe you just discovered it this year. I don't know, but we're going into our 11th year, which is a long time, over a decade. Oh my gosh. Anyway, this is Matthew McConaughey, this episode, and he was just incredible. Like, such a great dude to talk to. And it's on the heels of his book release called Green Lights, which you can either read in book form, but I recommend the audio version because he reads the audio version. And so what I find great about that, especially with performers, is that you can really hear the intention behind the stories, and especially because this is essentially autobiographical. And I say essentially autobiographical because it is an autobiography, but it's a philosophical journey. So it's not just, I was born and then this happened. It's really about, I was born and then these things happened, and here is what I extrapolated from that philosophically, how I kind of navigated these things. And so it is, there are a ton of lessons. You know, I listened to this book, and it's great because it's like, it just sounds like you're sitting down and hanging out with McConaughey for a few hours. And I took a lot of notes. There's just so many great life lessons. And he's definitely a student of life and someone who has always strived to do better, even through, you know, rocky times, through times when he didn't know what he was going to do. And also, you know, I wish I had brought this up in the podcast because I'm curious to know how he responds to this. But he talks about he mentions it a couple times in the book that when he was growing up, his favorite show was The Incredible Hulk. I also watched the 70s Bill Bixby Incredible Hulk, which, by the way, is the most depressing superhero, maybe one of the most depressing shows in the history, because it really was this sort of Greek hero's journey of, he was called David Banner in the series. They called him David Banner instead of Bruce Banner, but it's the same character. Because he basically is just the loneliest guy in the world. And it's just this Greek hero's journey of him trying to find himself and get back home being himself, I guess, his old life. But he's got this Hulk situation that he's got to deal with. And I find it interesting that, you know, this isn't give too much away, but Green Lights is really McConaughey's journey. And, you know, oftentimes when he would find himself in crisis, he would hit the road in search of himself, just go somewhere, you know, David Banner style. You know, he would go talk to shaman and he'd go talk to different people and try to get wisdom and understand and go on these trips. And for a long time, he lived like he had an Airstream, and he would just drive around the country and just, you know, just inhabit places for a while and then move on. And I wanted to ask him, like, do you think that was influenced by David Banner at all from The Incredible Hulk, who kind of had the same, and really, you know, even though David Banner was trying to find a way to quell the raging beast that dwelt within him, ultimately, David Banner and McConaughey were both searching for inner peace. They were both just trying to find it wherever they could. And, you know, McConaughey's green light means go, means move on. It means you can go to the next level, move forward. Banner's green light was gamma radiation and turned him into the Hulk. Ergo, the super saddest theme song ever. Oh, God, that theme song. I got to learn that on piano. The da-na-na-na. I cried every week when that show was on. You know, I don't think, you know, McConaughey's journey was sad like that every week. But definitely that sort of like the journey of trying to, of going outward to find inward, you know, and find that inner peace and find that wholeness. And he's very open about the whole journey and, you know, seems like he has become centered and kind of found peace. And so I really recommend the audio version of the book. I cannot say enough how much I enjoyed this conversation. He was just so fucking cool and nice and open to talk about anything and had such great information and so many great little nuggets of wisdom. So for me, this was like the perfect form of the podcast. Like, this is when I think the podcast is firing on all cylinders because, you know, someone came on. I knew who this person was very well, and admired their work. And, oh, guess what? They turned out to be rad. We connected right away. I learned a bunch of stuff. And by the end, it wasn't like, oh, I just had a guest on. It was like, oh, I had my friend Matt on. We just sat and shot the shit for a while. And I think you'll feel that way with him too. So thank you to Matthew McConaughey for doing this podcast. And thank you again for listening to this podcast and hang in there. And we will see you in your ears again in 2021. And until that time, stay safe, stay healthy, and let's roll the thing. La 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 la, sad hulky theme, McConaughey. I'll stop singing and start the thing. ID10T podcast. Rawr, rawr, rawr,
rawr. Initiating ID10T protocol.
Howdy, howdy.
Hey, man. How's it going?
We're good, man. Look at this. I love this Zoom stuff, man.
What?
So I love this Zoom stuff, man. Look at it. Works. Audio, video. Look at that. Lickety split. You get off
Remember when you used to have to fly everywhere and do shit?
And remember when doing this FaceTime, instead of flying, meant you were dissing the other person? Like, it really wasn't that important enough of a meeting?
And now it means you're a responsible citizen of the planet.
I'm in, man. In many ways, I look forward to continuing this form.
I've been trying to theorize, like, well, is it, like, there, it doesn't really feel like it's going to go back, per se, because I think a lot of people have realized, like, oh, maybe we don't need to spend money on offices. I do think there is an inherent benefit to having people like with a common goal in the same area, like teaming up and working stuff out. But I don't know if that's necessarily going to be the default anymore.
I don't think so. It's an interesting social experiment. We'll find out, because will people go back? Look, man, I mean, 95%. of the people, of the meetings I've had with people, I'm like, I prefer this. Now, there's that 5% I miss giving a hug or being in the room with, but I'm like, to the other day, 8 a.m., I'm in Italy on Zoom. 9 a.m., I'm in the UK. 10 a.m., I'm in New York. 11 a.m., I'm in L.A. for an hour meeting. And at noon, I'm having lunch live with my kids.
Yeah.
It is a green room, no hair and makeup, no travel, no plane, no waiting, no blah, blah, blah.
I mean, if you remember, what was it, maybe 91, whenever Total Recall came out and they had the video phones, yeah. And it was like, oh, my God, the future, you know, it's going to be so neat. And now we have them. And for the longest time, we were like, ugh, God, yeah. This is annoying. You can't make eye contact. You're like constantly looking down. And then all of a sudden it totally changed. And now it's like, well, this is how we're having our birthday parties, our meetings, our holidays, yeah. You know, for a lot of people. So I don't know. I don't mind it. I think it's pretty cool.
I don't either. I mean, in some ways, you know, in some ways it's more of an impression instead of a definition, but in some ways it's more intimate.
Yeah, I think so. Especially because we're like peering into, you know, it's like I'm in my home. I imagine either in your home or a hotel. But it's like it just gives you a sense of the. I really always used to think like you have to be in person. You can't.
Yeah.
It just isn't the same. Humans are. We're not designed to look at virtual representations. We're designed to see each other, read body language. You know, and now I'm like, I don't know. I feel like we're adapting to this, and it's not terrible.
I'm in.
I fucking loved your book, and I recommend that anyone get the audio version. I mean, listen, if you want the experience of turning a page, fine. But when performers read their own stuff, it just heightens it to this level of like it makes it experiential.
Yes, oh, good. Well, that was my favorite read of the book, the audio read. And I did it in about 8 hours. I think the book read is 6.5 hours if you buy it on Audible, but it took about 8 hours. People told me it's going to take like 4 days and it would take a really long time. But I guess because I lived the stories and wrote them, I knew where the punchline was coming. Or I knew who the next character was. And, you know, it was so fun doing all the voices and all the intonations of people.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, because it's, you know, to hear your intent and to hear when things are light or to hear when things have gravity or to feel, you know, it's like we'd kind of be doing the emotional math on that if we were reading the book. But to hear you perform it, it really is like spending, you know, 6 hours just hanging out with you. And it does feel like a hangout, which I think is partially why the book is doing so well. And also people are just fascinated by you as a creature. I think the storytelling and the aphorisms and the kind of like, you know, Southern country lawyer, you know, it all just, it's almost like, holy fuck, I'm listening to Matthew McConaughey do a Matthew McConaughey character. It's fucking amazing. I mean,
I love it.
It's just fun. It's just fun to listen to because it, and the sort of the philosophical, because I've noticed you've done, I was very fascinated by the fact that you've done some of the more philosophical podcasts. You did Ryan Holiday's,
yep.
And you did Russell Brand's.
Yep.
And, you know, I would say this one is on the cusp of that kind of like, what does it all mean, man, kind of podcast, you know. But the tone of it is really your philosophical journey. And about halfway through, I was like, I think McConaughey is like a truth grifter. He's like, he's trying to con the universe out of the truth. And then later in the book, you go, yeah, I think I'm like a grifter. I don't know. Am I a grifter? Or am I just trying to? And I'm like, holy shit. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I'm trying to work out the riddle like everybody else, man. Trying to get away with what I can and trying to pick out some things that last. I'm trying to find some non-negotiable things that I can rely on in a world where it's hard to find those. I sure believe life's a game. We're all on the same rodeo, trying to get our 8 seconds. And, you know, sometimes that means knowing your zone. Sometimes that means calling audible or right at the time. Sometimes that means sticking with the plan. But, you know, life's a sport. So sometimes you do got to grift and sometimes you got to hustle and sometimes you got to hustle in both senses of the words. And then, you know, as I say, you step in shit a lot of times along the way. And, you know, how you feel about it after stepping in shit is really kind of one of the arts of living. Because if you dwell in, you know, how bad your luck was, it doesn't do anything about the shit you stepped in.
Right.
You still step in shit. You know what I mean?
Eventually, so you have to get a stick and like scrape it out of the bottom of your shoe. And, you know, no matter how many times you shout it, it's not, the shit's just not going to fall off.
And you know, and if you are the one that has to scrape the shit off of your shoe that you just stepped in, well, you can either hem and haw while you're scraping it off, or you can giggle and go, what the fuck was I thinking while you're scraping it off? You know what I mean? You got the same outcome.
Yeah. I mean, I do kind of wonder how, because I think your ability to basically just throw yourself into the wind and end up where you end up and travel at will and travel the world, you know, go on motorcycle trips or just like put a trailer on a car and take off and like end up wherever. I think that sort of living that way in the physical realm, I feel like that must have prepared you for the emotional side of that, which is just like, well, whatever the day brings, I'm going to roll with it because I got to roll with it. You know, it's like, I still got to get up. I still got to go to bed. I still got to eat, take a shit, like all those things. Would you say that taught you that, or was there some of that going into all of the travel?
Look, I mean, my plan is to do this exercise and actually go through the book and say, okay, what things did you pull off? What successes did you have, McConaughey, that you wrote the headline first and then you set the goal and then you went after it and got it. And then how many are what you said? Dude, you just jumped off the edge of the cliff and said, I'm going to figure out how to fly on the way down. Yeah. And I've had great satisfaction and got to where I wanted to go or where maybe I needed to go and didn't know I wanted to go by both of those. So I don't know who's going to win that score. How much because I consider myself very pragmatic guy, very constructive, set a goal, lean into it linearly and go after it and make it happen and out hustle and hopefully get lucky along the way and da 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 da. But I go through my life and I'm like, boy, a lot of these, you jumped in the pool and you didn't know how deep it was or how wide it was. And you just like, I'm just trusting I'll come up on the other side, and did. You know, I mean, you know, I got that line in there somewhere in the book, but it was a line from my roommate in college, his great grandfather. He went back home to Alabama for spring break and came back really excited about what he had learned from his grandfather. I said, what? He goes, I said, what's the greatest advice you could give me? And his grandpappy was like 95 years old. And I said, what'd your grandfather tell you? And he goes, my pappy said, best advice I can give you, son, is right here. He goes, son, I've had thousands of crises in my life, and most of them never happened. So that was like, oh yeah. So maybe, you know, that part of that traveling and going around the world and seeing that, you know, shit usually doesn't go according to plan, or take that exit off the highway, go explore a little bit. You'll see where it goes as long as you're headed in the general direction. That's what I say. Like, give me 16 lanes in a general visionary direction, and then give us room to swerve. And then those swerves are where we're figuring stuff out, stepping in shit, hustling, grifting, doing all these different things. But if you can, we can trust that our direction, our compass is headed in the general direction. Hey, it's okay to get off the feeder road. It's okay to take some exits. Because if we're going east, if we're going to Miami and we know we're going east, we may end up headed towards North Carolina on the way. And maybe we could have taken the southern route, but we're still heading east. It's okay. Trust that. Let's see. We can put that one away and just trust in that, you know?
Yeah. And you'll still find, I think there was also something in there about like, it kind of doesn't matter what you choose, but just commit to your choice.
Yes.
Because whether or not you end up in North Carolina or Alabama or Chicago or whatever, you're going to find gems along the way. It's just sort of like which path do you want to take? It's not necessarily that one is better than the other, but
it's a really good point you're bringing up, and no one else has actually brought up that point, but that is so true. I mean, we've all done it sitting there, you know, look, on one side, we usually know what the choice is, but the art isn't like when to implement the choice, the timing, you know. But on the other side, I've done it. You sit there and you go, well, this or this, man, let me deconstruct this thing. And you're in limbo. And you look up a week later, you're still in limbo. You look up a month later, you're still in limbo. You look up a year later. I've got a friend who's been sitting there going, I'm not sure which one to do for 12 years.
Oh my gosh.
Just pick one. I mean, you would have already, if you'd have just picked one at the beginning and just commit to it and go, I'm in full hearted. I'm going to find out. That's a lot of times seems to be a good idea. It's like, it's not even about the which choice you make sometimes. Just pick one and commit to it and say, I'm going to find out. I may regret it. I may not.
Yeah. But that's also, I think that's also kind of the danger of assuming that life is a complete pass or fail. It's like 100% or zero. There's like a, you know, we're hampered by perfectionism, which is the complete enemy of anything creative or artistic. And that's why I think where we really get locked in, because we want to control the outcome, or we want to feel like this was perfect. And it's like, yeah, but you've already fucked it up, because you haven't decided. So there's not, right. Those choices probably aren't even the same anymore. Like everything, the world has evolved past where you are.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But I think that thing that the great grandfather said about the thousand crises is the sort of the imagined catastrophes and the catastrophizing, and, you know, especially now it's, you know, where we have a lot more time to sit around and catastrophize. But it's something that you sort of said at the end of the book about, and I think it has to do with like when we're too busy trying not to die or something, we don't live because our survival instinct, which is supposed to be helpful, can also hamper us in a lot of ways, right? Because you take it so literally, like, oh, I have to survive in the best possible way, that it makes you inactive and you imagine all these horrible things. And you're right, a lot of them, like, did it make your life better that you sat around and, you know, gave yourself an ulcer, like freaking the fuck out? I don't know.
Look, there's a way, there's an affirmative choice. There's a way to play offense in every situation, even if you're playing defense. I mean, like, to use sports analogies, the best defenses are on the front of the foot. You know what I mean? They're leaning in, they're anticipating, even though they're trying to keep you from getting somewhere. It's like what I say about, you know, yeah, I understand. Well, sometimes we want to run from things, or sometimes, yeah, we do fall. But in those moments, well, let's not run from something unless we have something that we're running towards. Mm-hmm. Or, hey, you're about to fall. Okay. Right before you, now, as soon as you, that instant moment when you know you're about to fall, jump. You know what I mean? Make the affirmative out of the defense. So that defense against, I don't want to fail, or, oh, I'm gonna die. I'm gonna try and keep myself from dying is playing defense, right? Rather than saying the people that live the longest and seem to be the happiest. And this is Dan Buettner found this out with Blue Zones when he studied centurions through society, people that live the longest. And the secret was they never tried not to die. They never tried to live longer. They never worked to live longer. They forgot to die.
Right.
So you see the inverse on it, that they weren't defending something. They were just moving forward going, I'm in the affirmative. Why am I living longer? I don't remember. What is it? Because you see a lot of doctors, it's like, no, it's because I forgot where the hospital was, or whatever that is. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, I didn't think about defending, or I have to work to see how long I can make it. And that leads into then the thing of what do we call success? What do we call quality? We measure it in America by more. You know,
right.
Live longer. Well, I'm like, I'm not sure. You want 60 happier or 90 not. I'll take the 60 happy. You can have the other 30, dude. You know. So what do we call quality? You know, right? And we got to watch that it's not always just about quantity. That's not always just a number.
But I think that's some of what the realization is, which hopefully is not temporary from the last 9 months, where we have realized, like, well, yeah, all these structures that we built up thinking that we were secure and the universe kind of has its own plan, you know, like, it's not, that's an illusion. But also, you know, look at how much we in the last, let's say, I don't know, 15 years or so, 20 years, maybe longer, really romanticize that kind of like Silicon Valley, like sacrifice your life, sacrifice your family, sacrifice your health for the bottom line, more, 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 bigger is better. And now, and as someone who kind of subscribed to that when I was younger, now I'm like, I think I like walking my dog. You know I like walking my dog with my wife at night. I know I don't want to work 7.5 days a week anymore. I know that it's nice to have space, and that I think is that what you're talking about, the balance, you know, like I think that is somewhere in there lies the success. Do you get to do some of the things that you want to do? Yes. Do you have to do anything that you don't want to do to survive? No. Well, then you are successful. What do you,
right?
Another $1 billion is not going to cement that anymore. It's probably going to create more stress, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. Well, we blindly follow that. You know, that's what we're told. You know, what do you want to succeed? What do you want to get respect, money and fame, baby? You know what I mean? And then we act surprised when those people are in leadership roles. Maybe they're irresponsible in their role. And we're like, what do you mean? We created it. Look at, just turn on the TV. Look at every advertisement, you know, more, more, more. No, don't go fix that toy, son. Let's just buy another one. You know? You know what I mean? New and improved. Wait a minute. Didn't our dishwashing detergent clean the dishes really good before?
Yeah, but if that doesn't connect to your phone and you can't see the dishes get washed, so it's a piece of shit. You need this new one that has all this technology that your last one didn't have. Oh, okay. Well, now it breaks more. Well, I don't know. It's
sort of Apple's the best at it. Hey, listen, how about this? We don't have to do much new with the phone, but let's change the power outlet and inlet, which means everyone's got to go back and go, oh, my Bose speaker, all the speakers, the holsters, I got to change all that. Yep. But, well, I got one here. No, that's not compatible.
Yeah. Well, not only just the actual literal physical compatibility, but also there's kind of this spectral social compatibility too. I mean, Apple above, and listen, this is the new iPhone. I have it. I get it every year. I admit that I am.
Hey, they got me too.
Exactly. Wow. The camera, you know, it's like, first of all, the last several generations of iPhone are such high quality that the detail in your mind, it's imperceptible unless you're like a crazy professional photographer. But to us, it was great a long time ago. But it's still, they have done this really brilliant job of conditioning us, A, that we always need the new thing or we're left out, and B, we buy things that aren't done. Like, there are still bugs in this phone, and we accept it. They have somehow hypnotized us into thinking, like, we need a new one, and I know it's not going to be done when I get it, but it'll catch up. And by the time it does, there'll be a new one. So,
the one that gets me is they don't deal. Oh, you know, someone tells you, don't update this new iOS. It's got all the glitches, right?
Yeah.
Well, that works for about a day. Notice how your phone starts getting really funky, and certain emails and contacts are going out of whack, and it's locking up. It's saying update. Remember the old iTunes, how cool and navigatable it was? I tried to hang on to that thing for so long I think my cord turned on fire one day. I think someone at the head of Apple was sitting back going, this number at this computer will not update to the new iTunes. So let's send a lightning bolt through his system. It was like
brick it.
You can't really curate. Well, I like this new thing, but I want to keep this old one. Like, no, turnover.
Progress at all costs. But I also understand from the flip side is that, you know, if they don't reinvent every year, then people start going, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they're losing it because they didn't. It's like, yeah, but wouldn't you rather have something that's, nah, fuck you. You know, it's like people want both. They want a new thing every year, but they want stuff to work perfectly. And it's like, I think ultimately people just want to complain. And that's really all it is. Yeah.
Well, and hey, you're right, man. Retail therapy. It's a real thing.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move,
or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by Noom. Forget one-size-fits-all diets. With Noom, you get a personalized weight loss plan that's tailored to your lifestyle. No food is off limits. Enjoy your favorites while discovering healthier habits. Noom's users love the flexible approach, blending psychology and biology to help you lose weight in a way that's sustainable for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
But that, you know, the perspective of hearing a very unfiltered, your point of view of your journey of like, you really did get famous in a weekend in a way that clearly was very jarring because you had to basically go on a walkabout afterwards. And have you kind of made peace with it? Cause it is a very strange when you just want to be a performer and you want to act, but it's like, well, I got to play this game a little bit so that I can get access to the types of things I want to do. But it does kind of tug at the ego and it kind of pulls and all these other, and none of that stuff isn't entirely real. So what is the balance and how do you keep it kind of tethered?
Yeah. Well, look, early on, as you brought up, I had to take several walkabouts to go be with myself to sift through the bullshit and the truth, or at least the best I could, and see what the hell mattered to me and let memory catch up, et cetera. I think, you know, one of the things came to me after 7 years in Hollywood, and it was probably the best secret that I had and learned after I was famous and how to deal with it. Get the joke. it ain't personal. It's business, baby. Now, as soon as I did that, then those people who I was had many dinners and, you know, was on the ballot to be their godfather to their children, that now that maybe my last two movies didn't do so well, won't return my phone call.
Right.
I'm like, oh, that doesn't bruise me anymore. Oh, okay. I get it. It ain't personal. I get it, dude. Yeah, cool. And now then I go make movies that do, and now they're calling me and I'm not picking that phone up. I'm like, yeah, I'll pick the phone up. I'm not even going to bring it up to them. I get it. It wasn't personal. I'm not, but if I wouldn't have got the joke, that person calls back later and you're like, fuck you, dude. I remember you wouldn't even, you know? So I'm like, just letting that shit slide. So part of it is, you know, I've played the game. There's a bit of a game to play. We were talking about life earlier, the Hollywood game. There's a game to play. I understood. I have, you know, I tell that Reign of Fire story.
Yeah, right.
I was aware that, I mean, look, it's not on the book of how to get a part, but I understood, oh, I just shaved my head. There's a picture of me with a really chalk white skull that has dents in it, and I do not look attractive. And now all of a sudden the studio's saying, you did not shave your head. And if you did, bad karma will come your way, aka yep. You'll lose the job. So I go, all right, let's talk about grifting again.
Yes.
Why don't I go tan my head really, really well and go get a really beautiful blue badass Gucci suit that accents my blue eyes, and I'm going to this Hollywood party where bigwigs will be, and I'm going to be in shape, and I'm going to be clean. I'm even going to, man, let's put some makeup on too, and go to it and look handsome, or as handsome as I can with a bald head. Well, it's no coincidence that the day after that party, when people had said that, oh man, you're really handsome, I love the shaved head, it's really cool, all of a sudden, that person that said, you're going to have bad karma or lose your job, is like, I love the bald head. You got the job. I mean, so I played the game, you know, I didn't lay down on my pride to do that. But if I wouldn't have done that, it wouldn't have been like, oh, I'm not doing that because I ain't changed for nobody. I was like, okay, I get this. Let's play the game here. I'm going to give them the opposite of what they think here. So let's go grift. Let's hustle.
Not everyone would do that, though. Like a lot of, you know, it's like you can rage against it. Like some people would rage against it, or they'd be like, fuck this. Or they'd be, but there is something in you, in your character, that just the same way that, you know, when you're in the village and they want you to, they think you're a fighter, and this guy comes up and it's like, they're like, you're going to wrestle this guy. And you go, well, I guess I got to do this. You know, it's looking at things as like challenges. I mean, that doesn't surprise me that you did Ryan's podcast, because that's a very stoic, like, how do I make the obstacle the way? How do I make this challenge? It's like, you see green lights as happening, but in some cases I see you as like kicking the fucking red light until it blinks, you know, green. And then, and then you go, I almost don't know if there are any red lights, because I think a lot of times you go, well, how do I make this red light a green light? Or how do I, so.
Well, ultimately I don't think there are. Like I said, I've talked about my father dying was a red light event this year, 2020, a red light year.
Yeah.
But where, you know, that him moving on was a big red light tragedy in my life. But man, did it give me green light assets, which I think I write about in the book, about I gained courage to be a man from him passing, of not having him there to rely on, to have my back, to now own up to the values that he'd been teaching me, but I hadn't really been practicing because, hey, he's got my back. Now, that's not making lemonade out of lemons. It's not. I'm not into that Hallmark card shit, but that is saying both are true. And he died, and that crisis is a red light. But boy, it gave me some lessons and catapulted me into becoming putting fast forward, really getting nitty gritty with becoming the man I want to become. So those are green lights. So ultimately, I don't know if you can say, that's why, you know, I'm still working on, do all red lights turn green, or do they just reveal green light assets via them? You know, the art is the yellow light. What do you do, man?
Do you speed up or do you slow down and stuff?
Exactly. Because sometimes we need to slow down for the yellow, which then turns to a red, and take a little introspective time like we've done this year. Take some inventory. Why do I keep stepping in that same pile of shit every time I come around this corner? Well, I keep stepping on it because I've run the yellow light every time. I just keep going. Get up, dust it off, be resilient. Come back around the bend, step in the same pile of shit again. Okay, dust off, carry on. Well, so we need the red light to look back and go, why do I keep doing that? But a lot of times we slow down at that yellow because, you said the word earlier, we almost think we want the pain. We want to turn the little crisis, the little problem, into a big crisis. We find ourselves dwelling in it and almost being victimized by it. When in hindsight, we ought to look at a lot of those yellow lights and go, fuck this, man. I'm putting the pedal to the metal. I ain't giving that crisis credit. You know what I mean? That crisis ain't going to get my time.
That's a great way to think about it. But also, at least in California, you can turn right on a red. You know what I mean? Like, there are other things.
Yeah.
Sometimes. But having been in the Dead Dad Club for 7 years now, I, you know, when you start talking about that, I instantly understand. And I think anyone who's lost their dad understands, because how to grieve and how to sort of feel a little more independence without your dad to rely on is oddly I don't want to say the last lesson they teach us, because I feel like, you know, at different points in your life, you're like, oh, okay, well, now I'm in my 40s. Oh, I get, you know, like you do have revelations along the way, or I don't know if you find yourself saying something and go, oh my God, that was my dad, you know, like having those moments. But it is that kind of like, holy shit, in death, they teach us stuff at the same time. It kind of never ends in a beautiful way.
Well, and how about these, one of the other
great lessons is that in death of a loved one, is that you find out that the messenger wasn't abiding by all of his messages. Mm-hmm. So again, in understanding sort of like Hollywood, it ain't personal, it's just business. You can go, come on, Dad, I can't believe that was all fast. You raised me on that, but you weren't even practicing that.
Yeah.
Or you go, okay, he wanted me to be a little bit better than he was. He may not have been able to follow it, but he wanted the best for me. Now, again, like stepping in shit, if our father dying is stepping in shit, either one of those two ways you look at it, our father still died.
Yeah.
So which way do you want to go?
Yeah.
Hemming and hawing him for going, I found out you had a bill, you know, that you owed money to somebody, and you said, told me, all you'd always taught me is never owe anybody money and pay your money, or whatever that is, you know, whatever that thing is, we find out where we see a crack in between what the message was given and what the messenger was doing. Outcome's the same. How can we take it and go, all right, I'm going to use it again. That's one of the lessons I've gotten from my father moving on. Cause I had some of those things where I saw the gap between what he was teaching me and what he was actually practicing.
But he probably just wanted you to not go through the same shit that he went through. You know, yeah. It's like the same way that for your kids, you probably say stuff. I mean, in the back of your mind, you're like, well, I don't know. I'm sure I've done that before, but you know, it's better to just kind of, you know, sure. Like, cause they're going to make their own fresh mistakes and you know, like you want to, but my dad was pretty open about that. He was like, oh, I don't want you to make the same mistakes that I made. He was pretty open about that. And I feel like we're about to start trying to have kids, I feel like I'll do the same thing, but I will sort of cop to like, look, I, you know, here are mistakes that I've made in my life, but you go innovate your own mistakes. don't do this or that.
Yeah. Evolve the mistakes, please.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But even just, you know, hearing you talk about that, talking about your dad and then the business. And first of all, whenever someone says it's just business, I always feel like, oh, I get it. You want to do something shitty, but you still want to be able to sleep at night. So you just couch it in this, like, it's just business. But that approach isn't just for the entertainment business. It's like, if we could apply that to the universe and not personalize everything, I feel like life would be a bit easier because we do tend to personalize everything. I mean, the universe does have that same kind of sense of humor of the business,
right?
You know? Yeah. And so
it's the business of living, the business of life. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
But it is, but you do have to figure out how to adapt to that. And that is just something that I think it sounds like you always kind of had that, or did you have to learn that?
I think that one of the top, if I had maybe the top trait that I got is from my family, what was instilled in us was resilience. We were taught to do what I was saying earlier. You fall down, man, you get back up, dust yourself off and carry on. And it's gotten me a long way in a lot of different ways in life. In my 20s, I noticed a loophole in that theory, that if you are ultimately so resilient, you become an absolute repeat offender in your mistakes because
you don't care about falling down
because you just get back up again and you step in that same pile of shit. And I remember, you know, going to my mom going, it's kind of like the golden rule, Mom. There's a loophole there. Doing to others, you would have them doing to you. But what if not everyone wants to do what you want to do? <You know? laughs> Loophole in that one. It's kind of like this resilience thing. And I said, but then, you know, my mother is an example. She's 88 years young, man. She is on it, man. She's with us because of COVID, not because she needed to be with us. I ask her this question. She's Miss Resilient and has never likes to be introspective. And now, mind you, she can talk about any subject, everything, loves both sides of an argument, all that stuff. But at the same time, I ask her, Mom, talking about message and messenger, because, you know, our parents become people become more outlaws. It's like you, when you're in 20s, you're revolutionary. 30s, 40s, you start to notice, hey, Mom and Dad were right. I think I'm going to be more responsible about these things. And around the 60s, people become revolutionaries again. They are inconsiderate, son of a bitches. They don't. Maybe it's because they see death coming and are like, I don't give a shit.
I think that's it.
You know? So I ask her, I go, Mom, you're fibbing and doing all this, getting with it. I said, what are all this stuff you taught us? I go, don't you have anything at the end of the day that you lay down and make a list of, like, I regret this, or I could have done this better. And she goes, oh, honey, I make a mental list every night before I go to bed. And it's usually 20, 25 items long of things that I regret, things that I could have done better, things that I want to improve on. I say, well, good. At least you're conscientious about that. She goes, but the thing is, when I wake up in the morning, I forgot them all. She's like an example of, like, the value of denial if you really commit to it.
Right. Well, you know? Yeah, but I also think it exemplifies the idea of life being a practice rather than a goalpost. You know what I mean?
Right.
Where you it's, and I guess it's sort of like, you don't go to the gym one time and go, well, I am fit for life. Boy, oh boy. You know, it's like, it requires maintenance. You don't have to do it, but then as you get older, your life might get a little harder.
Right.
And so but I think that applies to life too. It's like, yeah, you do have to keep reminding yourself stuff. You might have to do that every night when you go to bed, and then the next night and the next night. And just, but I guess, I don't know. Do you think the trick is just like, well, just deal with what you can deal with in a day, and don't take on, you know, the next 30 years every day of your life?
I think it's a bit of both. I think it's big day at a time with the big picture in mind, meaning I do think there's value. And this is why I'm a fan of people speaking about themselves in the third person, which I'm a big fan of. Because it actually informs it gives us another view of awareness about ourselves. Right. So we have the subjective eye. All right, I'm in it, my head's down, in process all the time, you know, and I know for me, the best work I've done in my life is when I finish on a set and they go, well, that's a wrap. And I go, okay, see you tomorrow. And they go, no, that means that's a film wrap. We're done. I'm like, oh, it's done? Like, my head was so down, I was just in it. At the same time, I do like to write a headline first. Where are we gonna go? Let's how far in the future can we project and be objective? Mm-hmm. To go, well, I'm going to hop out of myself and have a look at myself, who I am and how I'm doing is, and how the world sees me and my proverbial jumbotron in my mind and where I'm going. And let's go forward 10 years. So let's go to our deathbed and write our eulogy. And what would that be? That's an objective third person look at ourselves and our life that I right. think value in being conscious of. So I think it's just but what I think we have to watch is in today's world, with what we're doing now and every social media and everything else, we live in the objective too long.
Right.
We don't. And I do think you need to stay in the subjective. That's the day at a time you're talking about. The big picture in mind is the objective, but the subjective is primary. That what you said, just deal with what you guys can deal with right now today. I'm not projecting into the future. Watch, I'll look up and I'll be where I wanted to be. And if I just handle each day as well as I can, I do think it's very good to have the awareness of popping out to go, well, let's have a look at myself from the Google map in the sky and say, where am I? What am I? Where am I going? What do I want to do? But we can't stay there too long. It's like the NFL player that's running the kickoff back. And, you know, they get to the 50, they get to 40, they look up at the jumbotron. They start liking what they see. They've now gotten out of the process of what they do well, the behavior of running that ball back to get a touchdown. And as they're looking up there and going, oh, shit, man, I'm going to be on SportsCenter tonight. This is going to be on Plays of the Day. Man, I look good. That's when they get caught. You know what I mean? So if you stay in the objective too long, you'll choke at the proverbial finish line. You know what I mean?
That's a fun sportsy version of narcissist staring at himself in the water too long and just turning into a flower. You know, like that idea that you mentioned a couple times about, you know, I think it's like, don't be too impressed with yourself, or don't be too impressed.
Less impressed, more involved.
Yeah, because if you do stop too, but then again, it is about the balance though, because, you know, especially with the business, I've been working for like 25 years doing television and there's a lot that I'm still not comfortable with. And I'm so interested to hear your point of view from I think just we as creatures need to know I think ultimately the question we want to answer is, am I doing a good job? Am I a good person? Am I doing a good job? And
it's not like there are these necessarily linear cues for a creative arts business. And so what do we look to? Well, we look to these kind of fake metrics, like, or maybe not fake, but we look to these not entirely realistic metrics of like, well, how did this thing, did it, were the ratings high? Did it make money? What's the social media following? Or is my phone ringing off the hook? And a balance of that, I guess, makes sense if you want to keep doing what you're doing. But how do you kind of navigate and keep your social, keep your success cues healthy so that you don't, or what do you look at? I know you started to just pursue things that were only meaningful to you, but how are you doing it now?
Well, look, I'm in a really opportunistic spot right now for feeling satisfied with what I'm doing. The book was the most truest permanent extension of myself. It's doing well, which makes me very happy because I'm like, man, you wrote, directed, edited, you did everything. You lived it and you wrote about it. And oh, there's only one filter. It's the written word. We go perform. There's four filters from our raw expression. Somebody else's script, directed by someone else, lens in a camera by someone else, edited by someone else, before it gets to anyone else. So, you know, and then there's that third, there's that third act, which is that sort of that black hole, that blind spot. Like I've done quite a few movies that I am very sound with why I did them. Mm-hmm. And still sound. I am very sound with the experience I had in the making of it. But I don't know what the fuck happened when it came to marketing and came out, because it just fucking didn't work. And I'm like, well, it's a blind spot. What happened? Who? I thought, you know what I mean? Oh my gosh. And I didn't like that feeling. No one does, you know, but you know, what I'm doing, trying to do now is to have, no, I don't want to deal with all those other filters. I want to even maybe get rid of this one filter and go, challenge myself going, hey, what's the filterless character we're playing is in the big movie called Life. The one that action was called One Day when we were born, and cut will be called One Day. It's one take and there ain't no audition and we're in the middle of it. And so where are the hands of time watching? If you're a believer, you say God's the director, whatever that is. Well, I'm questioning, what do we do? What am I doing in this live show that we're living in? This filterless show. And I don't need a camera following me around to document it. But at the same time, cameras are on, you know, with relationships with people. Cameras are on. Cameras are on right now. We're having a conversation. It'll come out on your podcast cast. Some of it will be printed. Someone will grab a quote. So it's happening. There is a movie going on here that we're each in. I've just, you know, trying now to choose things that are, what are going to give me solar powered green lights, not the battery powered green lights, the ones that are going to light my path until I'm out of this life and beyond.
Right.
The things I can do that I can hand down to my children that they will inherently take the baton from me and carry on and maybe keep them alive or maybe even make them thrive. What, you know, that idea of going to our eulogy, as I write about, and saying, what's our story? What story is going to introduce us is a really cool exercise of being objective about who we are. And I found that, you know, the more we go to that place and go, no one likes to talk about death. I don't know what the big deal with that is, especially since it's one of the one thing we can rely on. It's like, you think about it and it's not a morose thought. It's actually an invigorating thought. It turns you on. It makes you go, oh yeah, none of it really matters. Fuck, that's why it all matters.
Yes, let's exactly. Go. Yes, exactly. Because I was about to jump in and go, yes, but that's what gives it. It doesn't matter, but none of it matters. But the death part is what gives it all meaning, because right. It puts an expiration date.
Yep.
And I have had the conversation with people before of like, well, if we were immortal, would anything mean anything? Because right. How would you really put specific values on thing if not for this kind of this endpoint, you know?
But it wouldn't have any form. It, right. would, it
there could be no, what would be the art if it's all just four dimensional? It'd be anarchy.
And that's what you, I think you say that really early in the book, where I think it's something about like creativity needs boundaries or it needs, and I completely agree that sometimes when you're given complete freedom to do something creatively, it can get a little sloppy because you need, it's like the, you know, the pain or the boundaries, like pain, I feel like pain kind of carves the reservoir that houses the soul, right? If that doesn't sound too hippy-dippy, but it's like those boundaries are the things that sort of create the, okay, now we're going to work within these confines and this is what we can create with that, you know?
You look at, you see independent films where people are forced to get creative that are better than some big budget things where people have, or you see that director who makes this great indie film and then gets the big studio budget and gets this endless budget and his next film's crap because he got all the toys. He had all the freedom and he wasn't forced to go, wait a minute, I got to deal with what's right in front of me. What's our best way to do this? We don't have a grip truck, so we don't have lights on this. So I think I'm going to go up here and just break this window so some light comes in. Or, you know what? Start that car, turn the lights, whatever, you know, there's something to it. You know what I mean? And then when you do get more, how do you not get complacent in that freedom? When
right.
you do get more toys and you do get more access and you do get more money and you do get more success, how do you still sit there and go, I'm still chomping at the bit, man. I want to feel like an underdog all the time. And everything around me is telling me, you ain't no underdog, man. You're leading the race. And I'm going, And again, that goes back to what we're saying. Who are we racing?
Yeah.
Elves. That's who we're racing. We're racing the same person we're chasing.
God, I just have to process that for a second.
Dude, it's the first time it's ever come out of my mouth. It sure sounds good.
Listen, green lights too, man. Green lights too. You need to make notes now because you're right. It is. And I don't think there's any, like, I love the openness of like, look, I was the rom-com guy for a while. And then when I kind of got bored of that, then I made the decision to do something else and you committed to it. And you turn down literally metric fuck tons of money because that was not the important thing to you. And then all of a sudden, the universe just goes, blah, you know, here's like four amazing things, you know, after almost 2 years of inactivity where I'm sure you were like, did I fuck my career? Yeah. But something about you made you stick to that and it did pay off.
Yeah, that was a calculated risk. I write about it. And look, I was taking a one-way ticket into limbo. I really didn't know if I was going to work in Hollywood again. You know, I write about it. It's like, what do you stay in your lane, McConaughey? You're like the go-to rom-com guy, man. What are you talking about? And trust me, my blood family, my brothers and stuff were like, what is your major malfunction, bro? What are you doing? And I was like, the way I told them, they were like, okay, we've heard him be convicted of bad ideas before, whatever. I don't get it. But well, 20 months later, yeah, it paid off. I unbranded to rebrand, so to speak. But I'll say this. I had, when that came, by the time the 20 months came, I was no longer wobbly in my limbo. I had found purpose because I had to deal with the family crisis. I found purpose because I had my son.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, there's two things, a new life and a crisis to try to keep continuing a life on, which we were trying to do with the family crisis, that took priority over me going back and acting again.
Right.
And so it was a little bit, if you believe in serendipity or grace or what have you, when my acting career became in the third place of my priorities and values, that's when the world went, here you go.
That's really interesting. It is. I actually, first of all, I took so many fucking notes from your book because it, you know, listen, I like, in general, I like self-helpy stuff. And this is self-helpy without being like on the nose self-helpy. It's just like, look, this is my life. This is what happened. This is how I navigated it. If anything in here helps you, great. But I took so many notes. Like, I gotta remember that. But the thing, one of the most impactful things I think was about not chasing butterflies, but planting, but putting in the plants that attracts the butterflies.
Yes.
And the chasing. I really do think the universe can sense when we're in desperation, and desperate things, people are suspicious of desperate things, because if you think about survival as a conscious thing, if something is desperate, there might be something wrong with it because it's needy. And if there's something wrong with it, then those genes might be flawed. And then that might not be good to, you know. So it's, how do we pull ourselves out of desperation? And I feel like when we pull ourselves out of desperation, either with relationships or work or what have you, that's exactly what you said. It's like, oh, you're ready now. But you can't force that. You can't just go, look how not desperate I am. Boy, yeah. I sure am. God damn it. I feel so, you know, you can't fake it. So what is that process of letting go? For you, I guess it was just having other things that were more important.
Well, and what was going on unbeknownst to me at the time was my success in rom-coms and my endless pictures of being shirtless on the beach had formed and created a character that not only the studios in Hollywood, but I believe viewers and audiences around the world have gone like, well, no, we don't believe you in anything other than that.
Right.
So I'm gone. Well, where is he? Damn it. It's about time for another rom-com. I'm kind of hating it. Where is he on the beach, man? I've been seeing him every other week in the magazines on the beach. Where is he? Huh? Oh, forget about him. I don't know where he went. Now I'm forgotten. Now there's a flatline, an anonymity. Then many months later, someone goes, this is going to be a crazy casting idea, but you know who's a new novel, interesting idea that I might want for this role in Killer Joe or Lincoln Lawyer? What about Matthew McConaughey?
What, the shirtless rom-com guy? Come on, what?
But where is he anyway? You know what? I haven't seen him. So, you know,
story, man. They love it. And I think that's like, look at Cranston in Breaking Bad. He had done comedies and sitcoms most of his career, and he's a great actor. And then all of a sudden you put him in this insane drama, and then people are like, holy shit, because they have this, you have this foundation of other stuff. And I think people just love to see people like reinvented or in a new refreshing light. And this thing that many people probably told you was very risky, when you look back now, you have the benefit of hindsight, but it's almost like, fuck, it would have been riskier to not do that, because that would have burned out your career without a doubt if you had stayed on that other path.
Bingo. It's exactly what my pastor said to me when I was talking to him about marriage with Camilla. What's the bigger risk, McConaughey? Going for it, taking the real adventure, or staying on the one you're on? And I was like, oh, you son of a bitch.
You found a loophole.
You know what I mean? It was riskier, you know, in hindsight to go, what if I wouldn't have, you know, said, bend to the knee and asked her to marry me? That would have sabotaged a lot of the beauty. And I would have not realized that the things I've, you know, seen and experienced so far in life with her. So, yeah.
I also find it really interesting. One thing that is a constant subtext in the book, although you refer to the process of it, but you don't quite say it. But I think when people think of, and obviously, you know, you, your family knows you, everyone else has this idea of you, they will get to know you more through this book. But just the, you know, that sort of, oh, McConaughey, what a laid back guy. He's on the beach. He's in sandals. He's like smoked a bowl. He's just fucking, you know, drinking a margarita. He's just, but what I see is like, yeah, it seems like he's laid back, but look at the amount of work. When you are focused on something, it really seems like it is, you are unimaginably focused on that thing. And your successes that you've had in life are the result of not just kind of engineering your own luck and, you know, like preparation meeting opportunity, but like real hard, even thinking like, well, I don't know if I can do three movies back to back because I need 8 weeks to prepare. You know, when you lock into something, you really, really work on it. And that is not an accident.
I would trace it back to an extension of what my dad told me when I wanted to go to film school instead of law school. Is that what you want to do? Yes, sir. Don't half-ass it. I don't know how to half-ass something. I don't. I mean, it's like, you know, it's that thing when someone goes, "Hey man, will you read the script for me?" I'm like, "Is it your final? Are you full confident in this? Because I'm going to give this one read, and let me tell you, if you and you want me to take notes on it, yes." I go, "Okay, that's about an 8-hour process for me, bro." Slow reader, because I'm taking it all in. And if I'm going to do it, this better be your. Because if it's no good, I ain't ever reading another one of your scripts. Do you really? Is this really the one you want me to read? Because if I'm going to really give it justice and take good notes, it's going to take 8 hours of my day. It's not an hour. It's not an hour flip through read for me. So I always, you know, I have to. It's why I have to watch what's on my proverbial desk now. You know, I don't. I'm trying not to do many one offs because I don't know how to. I don't know how to just all of a sudden find myself completely in it. And you're going, "No, you were just hired. Just show up and, you know, say your lines." I'm like, "I don't know how to just do that."
Right.
I want to be in all the meetings. I want to be, my eyes are open. I'm living this, man. I've got ideas. I want to be throwing them at you. It's an all encompassing obsession. And there's a great, I love being on that island. Love being on that island. But I do know that it means I'm not able to tend to a lot of other things in my life that are also maybe important and need tending to. So right. I've had times that, you know, I think I wrote about the book when I shut down the music label and the production company. I was like, I'm making B's and 5 things. Maybe I can make A's if I just have 3 things.
Right.
You know, because we only got 24 hours in the day. And there's many times we're like, when we're fortunate enough sometimes to go, I wish we had 36 hours in a day, but they ain't gonna
fill them. You know, like it's, then you'd want 48, you know, like there's yep. no, it is that like hedonic hamster wheel of like, it's never enough. It's never enough. So at what point, and you know, I see you as this guy who's this like experiential nomad. You really do just seem to gravitate toward like, well, what is the interesting experience? Not just the thing, but like, what's the experience yeah. around that? And I guess if, you know, just for anyone, just a piece of advice for you, obviously have a pretty strong gut that you follow because it draws you in all these different directions. That's either innate. That's either nature or nurture. I don't know. It either might be innate or is part of it just go in a direction and fall down and then get up again and keep going and fall down and get up and then your gut will develop. Do you think it is developable yet?
That's interesting. Well, yeah, I'm going to take the middle road and say it's both because sure, you do develop that with falling down again and again and butting your head up against the wall to get the same and only get the same outcome that you did not want. The definition of insanity, you know,
right.
You do that. It's a version of what my mom's talking about with, you know, but she's healthily insane because she just denies freaking while she scrapes it across your carpet. You know, she just says, "I didn't step in it." I'm like, you did. It's right there. It's on the carpet.
On your shoe. I see. Yeah.
No, no, it's not. It's not there.
There are flies. Oh, but I see flies. Okay. All right.
And so it's a mix of that that does, I think, develop a gut. But then at the same time, this and one of my great mentors, Penny Allen, I worked with her 19 years. She moved on a few years ago. Would tell me once I got in the place where I understood what acting was, and I understood how to get out of trouble and how to study and how to look at scenes and characters from multiple different angles. Her thing to me, when I'd start explaining this stuff, she'd cut me off. She'd go, you know, stop it with all this shit. You know, and just go do it. There's great power in that. You don't want to say that to someone who's like a rookie, right. You know, because whoa, wait a minute. Get to a certain point, we have to trust ourselves a little bit more and go, I know. And when when do we know? In those quiet times, night, you're alone, they're in bed, it comes to you. It's going, how do I not let that truth that I know, how do I not let that dim when the project that I know is really not for me, they came back with a little more money. You know what I mean? Or whatever that may be.
This might not be a bad script after this.
I can find an angle, you know? And I'm not.
I'm not a Puritan on this, dude. I'm, you know, I write that funny quip when I was in that 20-month sabbatical about getting only romantic comedies offered. And I would just read them and say no. And this one came in at $8 million. And I said, no. It came back in and they offered $10 million. I said, no. They came back in at $12.5 million. I said, ellipsis, ellipsis, ellipsis. No, thank you. They came back at $14.5. I said, let me read that thing again. And it was the exact same words as the original one, but it was a better script. You know, so I ultimately said no, but I was like, well, hang on a minute. This old one way, you know, pact you've made with yourself of not doing rom-coms, 14.5. Boy, you should have heard my brothers going off of me on that one.
Oh, I'm
what?
Sure.
What are you talking about, my guy, little brother? So you form them, but at the same time, yeah, I think we got to, there's times where you got to trust yourself. You're going to, when you said you're about to start working on making a baby.
Yeah.
Whatever your hunch is for the first 6 months after your newborn, quadruple down on it.
Because your instincts are like,
you are in tune, dude. Head, heart, what matters. It becomes instinctually, you have something in life now that you know you are responsible for taking care of because it can't take care for itself. Yeah. It becomes your ambitions, career ambitions immediately go to it at the highest number two on the list.
Yeah.
Just instinctually. And boy, right there, just quad down on things. Business, relationships, feelings, hunches, bet it all, man.
That's a good advice. Yeah. Cause that, I guess my body on a molecular level would be like, you are totally clued in and hyper-focused.
Yep.
Because you have to be to keep this being alive. So use those animal instincts.
When you get a quarter of an inch taller, chin gets a little bit higher, heart gets higher, all of it. You're like, yeah, come on. You know, the world is flat and you can see it.
I have a couple more questions for you, if that's okay.
Yeah, do it.
First of all, you know, what is an egotistical utilitarian?
Yes.
I heard you say it a couple times. I have a general sense of what it is. But I want to just hear a little more of a breakdown.
So, egotistic utilitarian. It's the it's a title for what I was calling the super man or the super woman. And in college, I'd written papers on it about there's a place where what we do is the most selfish choice is also the most selfless choice. And vice versa, the most selfless choice is the most selfish choice. There's a place where what we want, what we desire is actually what we need. And what we need is actually what we want. There's a place where we understand that there's a responsibility to freedom. There's a place where we understand that freedom is a responsibility. These things that we contradict, it's where the I meets the we, which is we know it, but we don't, we again, it lands on us quietly at night. That truth lands, but tomorrow, if you give me a little more cash for that thing, I'm going to go more just straight to who wouldn't? I mean, that's what, if you get offered that amount of money, that's what people do, right? Now I've jumped into the we, but I didn't jump to the I.
Right.
But I said yes to that rom-com at 14.5. Well, the we, that would have been like would that have been more selfless or selfish? Well, actually it would have been selfless because I would have been going against the truth that I knew to be true for me. And actually, it wouldn't have been the most selfish. Immediately, it would have been selfish because, oh, look at all the bank I got.
Right.
I wouldn't have 20 months later been open to the opportunities that have led me to where I am now. So it's the place where the decisions for the I are also the best decisions for the we. It's the best place where the decision for the individual is also the best for the collective and vice versa. But it always, I believe, has to start with the personal first. It has to be personal. As we talked about earlier, don't be objective to the extent that you've more than you're subjective.
I think right.
It has to be personal. Stay in the subjective. Stay in your own process and then be open to those things that are like, well, this is what the world does, right? I should do it. Who would say no to this?
Right. You know, I mean, that's all I say no to this. But at the same time, I completely understand what you mean because if you had done that, it wouldn't have been for you, and it wouldn't have necessarily been right for you. And also, I mean, this might be an extreme point of view, it could have cemented your career in that direction. Like, it could have tanked you a little bit. Like, that could have been, who knows, you know?
There would have been more of a gap between who I am in real life and who I am in my career. And I'm always trying to close those gaps.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, egotistical utilitarian is, yeah, ego's good, man. That's what I mean by you know. We have to know that and have trust in ourselves to have confidence. That doesn't mean you go be a tyrant.
Right.
That doesn't mean, that's not what it means. Now comes the responsibility. What's more selfish of me or you? To pick my pocket and I know you stole my money. So now every time you're around Austin, you're kind of walking along going, I can hope I'm not in here.
Right.
You may have got the $400 in my wallet yesterday, but now forever and tomorrow, you got to look over your shoulder.
Right.
So what was more selfish move? Well, if you didn't pick my pocket, now you can walk freely with your shoulders back and you ain't got to look over your shoulder because you didn't need crumbs. You right. bought yourself freedom. You did not put stress into your life. You did not create yellow lights and red lights in your future because you're not able to be present, because everywhere you go when you're in Austin, you're going, people, if anyone sees McConaughey, let me know.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a, even if it's just a short one, or I feel like there's another book exploring that idea of egotistical utilitarian. The exploration of where is that zone where the I meets the we is really, that's a really interesting space to occupy. Yeah. And it seems like there's another book in there somewhere.
It's one of the main pillars of the one that I'm heading towards next, because it keeps coming up and it's actually my greatest personal ambition that I have not achieved yet, but also understanding that you never achieved it. That's the fucking point.
That's the other kind of joke of the universe, is like, yeah, it's always,
you don't, there's no ta-da moment.
No. The goalpost is always going to move. But that's the point, is that you stay in pursuit of it. And that's where all the juice happens. And even to that idea, you've worked all these years, you've 20 months, you didn't work. You're trying to break this mold so you could be reborn, a phoenix rising from the ashes of this old, this former self. And all of a sudden you get all these amazing things and you know, Dallas Buyers Club, all these amazing movies and you're amazing in them. And then all of a sudden you get an Oscar and it's like, you're standing on stage. Obviously that's a very validating moment. It means something. How do you allow it to not mean everything so that you don't do that thing that we do about how you believe you're getting older? Oh, now I'm getting protective. Oh, you know, I got to play it safe now. I don't want to lose this. Oh shit. You know, like, How do you healthily accept that? What's the healthy amount of validation acceptance?
Yeah. Well, for me, I gave myself a little time to go, ta-da, I knew it. You know what I mean? Or I felt it. I believed it. I knew, you know, I gave myself a little time. But I'm very conscious that you didn't reach the peak. You got handed a trophy that is the greatest sort of acknowledgement in our business, or is considered to be, for work done excellent. I remember feeling like, ah, that means my craft translated. That means that I did what we do when we do our best performing, is everybody saw the we in my eye. I saw the we in my eye through the performance. It translated. We do a good performance, people see themselves in it. They see each other in it. Oh, I know that guy. Or, oh, that's part of me. So that translation happened. And I'm like, that's was my hope. That's kind of the intention. There was no gap between the two. Again, closing those gaps. And I talk about this. There's a difference between art and self-expression. I think all art is self-expression, but all a self-expression is not art, because no matter how honest any 13-year-old kid is writing in their diary, that doesn't mean it's art. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I felt like, I was even more, the more self-expressive I became, the more artful it became. I found that spot. I felt like I crossed that spot, rather to say. And that's what, you know, I'm still trying to do. But, you know, it's not, I'm not batting 100 and won't continue to bat 100 on this either, but that's the goal. That did validate me greatly to have my peers go, yep. And again, that it was a craft. You know, I didn't start taking acting classes until 1998. I didn't know what I was doing, but I kind of did know what I was doing. I had the right instincts for it, but I didn't know what the heck I was doing, what the craft was. So to get that and, you know, have that sort of that validation from my peers meant a lot. But it never, as much as I said, yeah, yeah, I feel great. I mean, look, pretty much the next afternoon, I mean, I still, you know, carry the trophy around.
Yeah, yeah, I have to.
Hey, I'm still going, yeah, I didn't want to dismiss and, you know, not give full respect to the moment, but I was already like, all right, you've had major opportunities before in your career, like after Time to Kill. It's like, what do you want to do? Which one of those can I do? All of them, whichever one you want.
Yeah.
I'm happy with my decisions then, but it was confusing. I was like, holy shit.
Yesterday, the birth of infinite choice.
You know, yesterday I couldn't do any, and now you're telling me I can do all of them? Whoa, hang on.
Like, what do I do?
But I was this time like, oh, if this gives me more power and more influence and more opportunity, I can know what I'm going after, man.
I feel like you're at the, there's this video that keeps popping up on my Instagram suggested videos, and it's one of Jim Carrey presenting an award at the Golden Globes. And I feel like maybe you're in the audience, but he goes, yes, it's me, two-time Golden Globe winner, Jim Carrey. And when I go to bed at night, I'm not a person going to bed at night. I'm two-time Golden Globe winner, Jim Carrey, dreaming about becoming three-time Golden Globe Jim Carrey, because then I will be enough. And the audience laughs in such a way where it's like, oh yeah, they get it. They feel they know that joke of like, this will make me enough. You know, of course it doesn't really. Right. But when are you comfortable with that? And when can you let that go?
Yeah. Remember, didn't he do it? He did a great one. He had a big opening. He had a $50 million opening. And he came out on the Oscars, and he walked out, and he had just opened that weekend. And it was amazing. He just walked out like super slow. He comes up and he goes, well, I had a great weekend. How about you?
But it's that idea of like what you were saying before of not taking any of it seriously and understanding that there is that joke and it's not personal. And, you know,
let me throw on this though.
Yeah.
But taking it all very seriously.
But not yourself.
Well, no, taking yourself even more seriously.
Okay.
I mean, I always say this. Comedy. Do you take comedy seriously?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm with you. I take my comedy seriously, man.
Yeah.
Serious about comedy, about what I think's funny and what's not. let me make another flip on play on words that it has helped me. I love to be in the know. I want to know, man. Well, I also want to know what I don't know.
Right.
But I'm still in the know. I'm still in the affirmative. I know. I also know what I don't know. I like to know what I know and what I don't. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm serious about this. I'm serious actor. I'm serious about comedy. Damn right. You know what I mean? I know it's a bit off the beat that you were hitting on.
Not really. I mean, I get what you're saying though, because you do have to take the work seriously, because if you didn't, then you wouldn't do the work, you know, like it has to mean something to you and it has to have gravity.
But let me say this, that winning that trophy, winning that award or whatever that is, that pinnacle, right?
Yep.
Again, I'm venturing to say, if you take yourself seriously enough, you know that that's not the end all be all.
Right.
You know that that's part of the journey and you reached a peak on that certain hilltop, but that's one of the tops in life.
that if you really take yourself seriously, you're like, fucking cool, man. Badass. Yes, I did that. With a lot of help from a lot of other people. Yes. And a lot of things went away, all that stuff. But yes, this is mine. This is mine. I'm going to give myself credit for that. This isn't who I am.
Right.
It's part of who I am. And way to get to the pinnacle on that one. But it's not, this does not identify me.
Right. That's the healthy part.
Take yourself so seriously to be able to do that, I think, is what we're, what I think we could do more of.
And not have it mean everything.
It doesn't mean everything. And again, if we look at it like we never know and we never get there, I got this title that I'm working on that is also maybe for the, it purports or it around what the next book would be about. Chasing Yet.
That's a great title.
Personally and professionally, collectively as individuals, as nations. We ain't never gonna get there. It's not gonna be a utopia. But if we can keep churning every day, going getting a little bit better, a little bit closer, that's as good as it gets. It's like science being the practical pursuit of God. You don't get there.
I'm so glad you brought up the G word because I, you know, listen, I'm a lapsed Catholic. I went to all boys Catholic school. When I went to college, I was a philosophy major and became, I guess what you would say, agnostic, atheist, agnostic. Now, I don't really know what I believe, but also having been sober for 17 years, but I used to really bristle at like, release to God, release to God. And when I used to hear the word God, I used to go, oh, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. And as I've gotten older, maybe it's wisdom or acceptance or whatever, when I hear it, I go, look, even if you don't buy into the old man with the white beard sitting on a cloud, you know, it the idea is that we are not in control of anything, really. I mean, we're in control of our how we react to things. We're in control of, you know, but maybe the idea is like, hey, you're releasing control to something that's bigger than you. There's something that's bigger than you. And you are acknowledging that you are not the center of everything and something is bigger. And so the release of that is like, oh, I think I get the G word now from that point of view.
And what have we been talking about? It's come up many different times in this conversation. When we're chasing is not top of the list.
Yeah.
In the second or third spot or whatever, we do it better a lot of times.
Because we're not trying to control it.
Right. Yeah. You know, so I think it's shaking hands with that fact, whatever that is for someone, whether it's the G word or whatever that is, spirituality, that you go, you know, it's again, it's that place. What's it matter? Oh, shit. That's why it all matters. You know?
Oh, my God. This has been such a wonderful conversation. And having listened to the book, I already felt like I spent a handful of hours with you. But this was just such an absolute joy to be able to really deep dive into just the stuff that stuck out to me in the book. And I really hope people listen to it, or at least read it, but listen to it and really experience it, because you are, you know, you are an experience, and your experience will inform other people kind of figuring out their own experiences. I hope you know that. As therapeutic as I'm sure this was to you, I do believe that this book will kind of help people start to find their own way.
Wow. That's really cool of you to say. Thank you. Look, in whatever way, that'd be awesome. You know, and you know, if we can each help each other on our own way, help ourselves on our own way and help others on their own way. If we can do that, we all got job security forever.
Well, thanks, man. I hope you and your family are staying safe and healthy in this very surreal timeline that humanity is in. But, you know, I also think this book came out at the right time because it feels, it's very hopeful feeling. It just feels like I felt like I'm a freshman and there's a senior sitting me down going, hey man, you're going to get through high school. It's going to be tough. Don't you worry about it. I'm like, oh my God, a senior sat down and talked to me. I can't believe this. I feel fucking, this is so cool. You know, this is going to be rough, but you're going to get through it. I got through it, you know, it all, you know. And I think that is also the other thing in the bigger picture that is going to be helpful for people, is that it does feel hopeful at the same time.
Heard, man. Well, I'm with that. I think that, you know, a little hope never seems to go out of style. You know, there's a lot to be hopeful about, man. There really is, especially now coming out of this year. Everyone's looking for new beginnings, man, and we could all use one.
Cool, man. Well, again, this was a real pleasure, and I hope you hang in there, man. I hope to see you again sometime.
You as well. See you hopefully in the new year. All right.
All right. Take care.
I'll be good.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think, some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fu,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondry and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondry app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondry Plus in the Wondry app or Wondry Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Once Upon a Beat.